理课堂听 class.com
Grade 8 Paper 1 Part 1 Listening Comprehension In sections A, B and C, you will hear everything once only. Listen carefully and then answer the questions that follow. Mark the correct answer to each question on your coloured answer sheet. Section A Talk Questions 1 to 5 refer to the talk in this section. At the end of the talk, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now listen to the talk.
When we talk about a modern company, we usually have managers, employees, products, research and development, or marketing in mind. However, in reality, a company is not just made up of these elements. There are other things that make a company what it is. This morning, we are going to look at some other aspects of a company. Let's first take a look at the offices. The physical surroundings of most modern companies, especially offices, are becoming more and more similar. Although there are some differences from country to country, one office looks much like another. Office furniture and equipment tends to be similar: desks, chairs, filing cabinets, computers, etc. What is important about offices, you may ask? Well, the atmosphere of the workplace can often influence the effectiveness of a company's employees. Modern offices are more spacious and better lit, heated, ventilated, and air-conditioned than in the past. But of course, this is a feature that varies from firm to firm and may be dependent on the size of the company and its corporate philosophy. In some companies, the employees work in large, open-plan offices without walls between the departments. In others, the staff members work more privately in individual offices. No matter what the office layout is like, modern companies pay special attention to the physical surroundings in order to create an atmosphere conducive to higher working efficiency. Another related point when talking about offices is the work relations with other people at the place of work. They include relationships with fellow employees, workers, or colleagues. A great part of work or job satisfaction, some people say the major portion, comes from getting on with others at work. Work relations will also include those between management and employees. These relations are not always straightforward, particularly as the management's assessment of how you're performing can be crucial to your future career. Now, I'd like to say a bit more about the relations between management and employees. There will also be matters about which employees will want to talk to the management. In small businesses, the boss will probably work alongside his or her workers. Anything that needs to be sorted out will be done face-to-face as soon as a problem arises. There will be no formal meetings or procedures. But the larger the business, the less direct contact there will be between employees and management. Special meetings have to be held and procedures set up to say when, where, how, and in what circumstances the employees can talk to the management. Some companies have specially organized consultative committees for this purpose. In many countries of the world today, particularly in large firms, employees join a trade union and ask the union to represent them to the management. Through the union, all categories of employees can pass on the complaints they have and try to get things changed. The process through which unions negotiate with management on behalf of their members is called collective bargaining. Instead of each employee trying to bargain alone with the company, the employees join together and collectively put forward their views. Occasionally, a firm will refuse to recognize the right of a union to negotiate for its members, and a dispute over union recognition will arise. Where there is disagreement, bargaining or negotiation will take place. A compromise agreement may be reached. Where this is not possible, the sides can go to arbitration and bring in a third party from outside to say what they think should happen. However, sometimes one of the sides decides to take industrial action. The management can lock out the employees and prevent them from coming to work. This used to be quite common, but is rarely used today. The main courses of action open to a trade union are strike, a ban on working overtime, working to rule, that is, when employees work according to the company rule book, go slows, which means that employees may spend more time doing the same job, and picketing, which means that employees stand outside the entrance to the business location, holding up signs to show that they are in conflict with the management. Every country has its own tradition of industrial relations, so it is difficult to generalize. In some businesses, unions are not welcomed by the management. But in others, the unions play an important role both in the everyday working relations of individual companies and also in the social and political life of the country.
Section B, Interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on an interview. At the end of the interview, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the following 5 questions. Now listen to the interview. If you're going to create a TV show that deals week after week with things that are unbelievable, you need an actor who can play a believer. You know, a person who tends to believe everything. Tonight, in our show, we have David Duchovny, who has starred in the popular TV series The X-Files. Thanks to his brilliant performance in the TV series, David has become one of the best-known figures in the country. Good evening, David. I'm so glad to have you here.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
David, have you often been on radio shows?
Oh, yes, quite often. To be frank, I love to be on the show.
Why?
You know, I want to know what people think about the TV series and about me, my acting, etc.
Okay, David. Let's first talk about the character you played in The X-Files. The character, whose name is Mulder, is supposed to be a believer. He deals with those unbelievable, weird, and often bizarre things and events. He must be, Mulder, someone who really believes in the things he meets in order to keep on probing into those mysteries.
That's true. Remember those words said by Mulder? What is so hard to believe? Whose intensity makes even the most skeptical viewer believe the paranormal and outrageous government conspiracies? With every reason to believe that life, in the persistence of it, is driving us out of our terrestrial sphere, etc., etc.
Fabulous. I guess, David, your contribution to the hit series is credibility. Now, let's talk about your personal experience. From what I've read, I know that starting from your childhood, you were always a smart boy, went to the best private schools, accepted at most of the Ivy League colleges. Not bad for a lower middle class kid from a broken family on New York's Lower East Side. So imagine Mum's surprise when you, who were on your way to a doctorate at Yale, took a few acting classes and got bitten by the bug.
You bet. My mother was real surprised when I decided to give up all that in order to become an actor.
Sure. But talking about Mulder, the believer in the X-Files, what about you, David? Do you believe at all in real life? The aliens? People from outer space? You know, UFOs? Government conspiracies? All the things that the TV series deal with?
Well, government conspiracies, I think, are a little far-fetched because, it's very hard for me to keep a secret with a friend of mine, and you're going to tell me that an entire government is going to come together and hide the aliens from us? I find that hard to believe. In terms of aliens, I think that the odds are there must be.
But you could believe in aliens?
Oh, yeah.
The character you played in The X-Files, Fox Mulder, is so dark and moody. Are you dark and moody in life?
I think so. I think what they wanted was somebody who could be this haunted, driven person, but not behave in that way, and therefore be haunted and driven, but also appear to be normal and not crazy at the same time. And I think that I can offer that.
What haunts you now? What drives you now?
What drives me is failure and success and all those things, so...
Where are you now? Are you haunted and driven? Failed or successful? Which?
Yeah, both.
All of the above?
I always feel like a failure.
Do you mean now you feel like a failure?
Yeah, I mean sometimes, you know, like I come back to New York, so it's like everything is different. So I lie in bed and think, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, very different. Maybe I'm doing well. But then I think, you know, there are just so many other things that I want to do and...
Your father and mother divorced when you were 11. Does that have an effect on your life today that you recognize?
Well, yeah. I think that the only way to think of it is that, you know, people are saying your wound is your gold, you know. Wherever you're hurt, that's where you become stronger. So that's what it's really about.
Okay, it's time for a short break. We'll be back in a minute. David Duchovny and the X-Files. Don't go away. Section C, News Broadcast. Question 11 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news.
The Bush administration is warning that continuing Mideast violence threatens to overwhelm U.S. efforts to revive Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, using the recommendations of the Mitchell Commission to bring the two sides together. Administration officials are openly worried that the violence, and particularly the car bomb attacks aimed at Israeli civilians, could undermine what they see as a positive opening toward renewed peace talks presented by the Mitchell Report. The U.S. appeal came in the wake of the bomb blast Wednesday in the Israeli coastal town of Netanyahu that injured several Israelis. Responsibility for the bombing was claimed by the Palestinian group Islamic Jihad. At the State Department, spokesman Philip Reker said there can be no justification for terrorism and the targeting of civilians. And he urged the Palestinian Authority to do all it can to put an end to such incidents, which he said threatened to overtake the latest peace efforts.
Question 12 is based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer the question. Now listen to the news.
Voters in Peru headed to the polls today to cast their ballots in a runoff presidential election that many hope will mark the end of the nation's political crisis. Opinion polls last week showed the moderate candidate Alejandro Toledo with a narrow lead over a left-leaning former president Alan Garcia. Both candidates have campaigned on similar populist platforms. Meanwhile, pre-election surveys indicate that up to 25% of voters in Peru plan to spoil or leave their ballots blank to show their dissatisfaction with both candidates.
Questions 13 to 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 15 seconds to answer each of the questions. Now listen to the news. Canada, for the seventh consecutive year, ranks as the best place to live in the world. But if you are a woman, you are better off in Scandinavia, says the UN Human Development Report 2000, released yesterday. Norway is in second place in overall ranking, followed by the United States, Australia, Iceland, Sweden, Belgium, the Netherlands, Japan and Britain. Finland is in 11th place, followed by France, Switzerland, Germany, Denmark, Austria, Luxembourg, Ireland, Italy, and New Zealand. At the other end of the scale, the 10 least developed countries that provide the fewest services to their people. From the bottom up are war-devastated Sierra Leone, Niger, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Burundi, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Chad, Central African Republic, and Mali. Section D, note-taking and gap-filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on answer sheet 1 after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Now listen to the mini-lecture.
Good morning, everybody. Today's lecture is about Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. This seems like a psychological topic. Actually, it is something psychological. Abraham Maslow is a psychologist, and he's especially known for his theory of human needs. Okay, first of all, what is a need? Here, we can simply define it as a personal requirement. Maslow believed that humans are wanting beings who seek to fulfill a variety of needs. According to his theory, these needs can be arranged in an order according to their importance. It is this order that has become known as Maslow's hierarchy of needs. In this hierarchy of needs, at the most basic level, are physiological needs. Fundamentally, humans are just one species of animal. We need to keep ourselves alive. Physiological needs are what we require for survival. These needs include food and water, shelter, and sleep. At this level, for us humans, Maslow also includes the need for clothing. How are these needs usually satisfied? It is mainly through adequate wages. Then, what is the next level of needs? At the next level are safety needs, the things we require for physical and emotional security. Physical security is easy to understand. Everybody needs to keep his body safe from injury, illness, etc. Then, what is emotional security? Well, that's maybe the point in this hierarchy of needs where humans begin to differ from other animals. We are thinking animals. We have worries. What if I lost my job? What if I were struck down by a severe disease? Besides physical security, we need to think we are safe from misfortunes both now and in the foreseeable future. How can these needs be met then? According to Maslow, safety needs may be satisfied through job security, health insurance, pension plans, and safe working conditions. After this stage come the levels of needs that are particular to human beings. The immediately following level are the social needs. Under this category, Maslow puts our requirements for love and affection and a sense of belonging. We need to be loved. We need to belong to a group, not just a family, in which we can share with others a common interest. In Maslow's view, these needs can be satisfied through the work environment and some informal organizations. Certainly, we also need social relationships beyond the workplace, for example, with family and friends. Next, the level of esteem needs. What are esteem needs then? They include both the need of self-esteem and the need of esteem of others. If no better, then is a sense of our own achievements and worth. Respect and recognition we gain from other people, we are no worse in work or our activities in other social groups. Of others is the resist to satisfy esteem needs include person either through our promotion to more responsible jobs, various the way and other forms of recognition. Personal achievements is the top level of this hierarchy of needs. These honors and awards are the self-realization needs. In other words, what follows is to grow and develop as people, the needs these are capable of being. These are the words, they are the needs by. Whether one can achieve this level to become all that we are, perhaps determines whether one can be a great man, most difficult needs to satisfy man. Of course, it depends on different level or not. The means of satisfying them tend to vary greatly or just an ordinary level. For some people, learning a new career after retirement could quietly with the individual self-realization needs. Skill, starting people, it could be becoming the best there will satisfy their ideas. It could be becoming the president of I. While for other, anyway, being great or ordinary is in certain areas, self-realization is largely individual. BM. It was suggested that people work to satisfy their physical what others think, whilst then their safety needs, and so on. Maslow, in general, they are motivated by the needs, logical needs first, remain unsatisfied. However, up the needs ladder level, do not have to be completely satisfied at the lowest level that next higher level come into play. Needs at one person's physiological and safety needs are before needs at the that person will be motivated primarily by if the majority of a but any physiological and safety needs satisfied that will keep playing an important role by social needs. Okay. That's the general picture of Maslow's hierarchy that remain unsatisfied. Just to sum up, I've briefly introduced to you. Okay, Maslow thinks there are five kinds of needs, each one being more important than the preceding one. Maslow's theory found his ideas interesting, and in our next lecture, Human Needs, with each discuss the practical implications of his theory. I hope that
you have 2 minutes to check your notes.
A lecture will mainly
the 15-minute gap-filling task on answer sheet 1. And please complete the 50.
Test for English Grade 8, 2004. 1. Part 1. Majors. Grade. In sections A, paper B, you will hear everything once only, listening comprehensively, and then answer the questions that follow. A, B, and C. The correct answer to each question on your. Listen carefully. Section A. Mark questions 1 to 5 refer to your colored answer sheet section. At the end of the talk, you talk. 5 seconds to answer the questions. Refer to the talk and listen to the talk. You will be given 70
things. People use it in.
Now listen.
For transacting business, planning meals, language is used for debating politics and gossiping. Everyday conversations use it for instructing students and comedian vacations, audiences. All these are. Teachers use, that is, activities in which people do use it for amusing. As we can see, are instances of language, a form of joint action. What are things with language? I think it is an action that is carried. Language use is really people doing things in coordination with each other. What is a joint action? As simple examples, think of two people carried out by a group of people, piano duet. When they each move around the ballroom in a special way, waltzing, or playing a. But waltzing is different from the sum of their individual. Two dancers waltz. Can you imagine these two dancers? But in separate rooms or at separate times, dual actions. Waltzing is, in fact, the joint action that is doing the same steps as do their individual steps in coordination. Similarly, doing merges as the two dance also different from the sum of a speaker speaking and as a couple. It is the joint action that among things with language is us and listeners, all writers and readers, and a listener listening. Dual actions in coordination, as on some merges when speakers. Therefore, we can say that languages perform their individual and social processes. And listeners, writers and readers must language use incorporate individuals if they are to succeed in their use. Speakers, but they must also work together as part carry out actions as units I have called ensembles. Use of language. Mentioned just now, the two dancers perform participants in the socials, moving their bodies, arms and legs. In the example of coordinating these movements as they create both individual action. In the past, language use has been and joint actions entirely an individual process. The waltz. Studied as if it were entirely a social process. Studied as if it were. I suggest that it belonged to both. And it has also been stand language use without viewing it as joint actions. For me, actions. In order to we cannot hope to understand's work, I'd like to review briefly settings built on individual. By settings, I mean the scene explain how all these actions takes place, plus the medium which refers to things of language use, spoken or written. And in this talk in which the language use of spoken settings. The spoken as to whether language use is done is conversation, either face-to-face, I'll focus on conversations may be devoted to setting mentioned most of transactions or scientific matters, voice or on the telephone, is by the free exchange of turns among the two on the gossip, business. I will call these personal settings. They are all characterized. We have what I would call non-personal settings or participants. Example is the monologue. In monologue, then speaks with little or no opportunity for interruption. A typical example members of the audience. Monologues logs one person two, as when a professor lectures to a class or turns by giving a presentation in a seminar. Come in many varieties to speak for themselves, uttering words they force, or a student or the audience before them, and the audience is these people abrupt. In another kind of formulated themselves institutional settings, the participants expected to interchanges that look like ordinary conversation setting which is called institutional rules. As example, engage in speech exchange government official holding a news conference, but they are limited by questioning a witness in court, or a professor's, we can think of a discussion. In these settings, a lawyer cross or less spontaneous, even though turns at speaker directing a seminar by a leader, or are restricted in other ways. What is said is more a person speaking isn't always the one whose intentions are allocated. We have the clearest examples in fiction. Vivian Leigh plays Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Winds are being expressed. Frank Sinatra sings a love song in front of a live audience. Channel settings are each vocalizing words prepared by someone else. Wind. France, a playwright or a composer, and are also the speakers expressing intentions that aren't necessary, for instance. Finally, there are private settings openly pretending to speak for themselves without actually addressing anyone necessarily their own. For example, I might explain silently to myself in which people myself about solving a research problem or else, for to say in a seminar tomorrow. What I self or talk to it to be recognized by other people, it is only rehearsing what I'm about. These are the features of private setting. Say, isn't intent of use to myself.
Section B. Interview. Questions 6 to 10 are based on... At the end of the interview, you will be given seconds to answer the questions. Interview.
Good evening. I'm Nancy...
5 seconds.
The guest on our radio talk this evening is Professor Wong.
Listen to the...
Hello, Professor Wong.
Hello.
Professor Johnson, you're now Professor Emeritus of Australian National University, Gongwu. And in your long academic career, you've worn many hats, Wong, lecturer, department head, dean, professor, and vice dean. However, as I know, you are still very fond of those two university days as a student.
That's right. That was in 1999. The university I went to was a brand new university.
Your university?
And the only one in the country at that time. When I looked 49, it was an amazingly small university, and we knew everybody.
How did the students like you, for example, study then?
We did not study very hard, because we did not have to. We didn't have all this fantastic competition that you have today.
Mm.
Hey, we were always made to feel that getting a first degree in the arts faculty was not preparation for a profession. It was a general education. We were not under any pressure to decide on our careers, and we had such a good time. We were left very much on our own, and we were encouraged to make things happen.
What do you see as the most striking difference in the present-day education since then?
University education has changed dramatically since those days. Things are very specialized today.
Yes, definitely so. And in your subsequent career experience as an educator and later administrator in various institutions of higher education in Asia and elsewhere, Professor Wong, you have repeatedly noted that one has to look at the development of education in one particular country in the broad context. What do you mean by that?
Well, the whole world has moved away from elite education in universities to meet the needs of mass education. And entering universities is no longer a privilege for the few. And universities today are more concerned with providing jobs for their graduates in a way that universities in our time never had to be bothered about. Therefore, the emphasis of university programs today is now on the practical and the utilitarian, rather than on a general education or on personal development.
Do you think welcome development?
Well, I personally regret this development, but the basic bachelor's education now has to cater to people who really need a piece of paper to find a decent job.
So you're concerned about this development?
Yes, I'm very concerned. With technical changes, many of the things that you learn are technical skills which don't require you to become very well educated. Yet, if you can master those skills, you can get very good jobs. So the technical institutions are going to be increasingly popular at the expense of traditional universities.
Professor Wong, let's look at a different issue. How do you comment on the current phenomenon that more and more universities admit students because of the fees they pay?
Well, once you accept students on financial grounds, one wonders whether you have to pass them as well. But this is the development in education that we have to contend with. Yet, if we are concerned about maintaining standards, what we can do is to concentrate on improving the quality of education.
Yes, you're right. A university is judged by the quality of education it offers. Professor Wong, let's turn to the future. What type of graduates, in your view, do universities of the future need to produce if they are to remain relevant?
I think their graduates must be able to shift from one profession to another because they are trained in a very independent way. If you can do that, you raise the level of the flexibility of the mind. Today's rapid changes in technology demand this adaptability. And you see the best universities in the world are already trying to guarantee that their students will not only be technically trained, but can be that kind of people that adapt to any changing situation.
I guess many people would agree with you on that point. University education should focus on both professional and personal intellectual development of students. But still, some might believe that there is a definite place for education in the broader sense. That is to say, in personal intellectual development.
No doubt about that. We need people who will think about the future, about the past, and also people who will think about society. If a society does not have philosophers or people who think about the value of life, it's a very sad society indeed.
Professor Wong, my last question. Do you see any common ground in education between your generation and the young generation now?
Adapting to new challenges is perhaps the true cornerstone of our generation's legacy to education. And the future of education in a country rests not so much in the construction of better buildings, labs, etc., but in the development of an ever-adaptable mind.
That's true. The essence of education is the education of the mind. Okay, thank you very much, Professor Wang, for talking to us on the show about the changing trends in education.
You're welcome. Section C. News broadcast. Questions 11 to 13 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 45 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news.
A new data shows that the global AIDS pandemic will cause a sharp drop in life expectancy in dozens of countries, in some cases declines of almost three decades. Several nations are losing a century of progress in extending the length of life. Nations in every part of the world, 51 in all, are suffering declining life expectancies because of an increasing prevalence of HIV infection. The impact is occurring in Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, but is greatest in sub-Saharan Africa, a region with only 10% of the world's population, but 70% of its HIV infections. Seven African countries have life expectancies of less than 40 years. For example, in Botswana, where 39% of the adult population is infected with HIV, life expectancy is 39 years. But by 2010, it will be less than 27 years. Without AIDS, it would have been 44 years. Life expectancies throughout the Caribbean and some Central American nations will drop into their 60s by 2010, when they would otherwise have been in the 70s without AIDS. In Cambodia and Burma, they are predicted to decline to around 60 years old, from what would have been in the mid-60s. Even in countries where the number of new infections is dropping, such as Thailand, Uganda, and Senegal, small life expectancy drop is forecast. Back in the early 1990s, we never would have suspected that population growth would have turned negative because of AIDS mortality. In less than 10 years, we expect that five countries will be experiencing negative population growth because of AIDS mortality, including South Africa, Mozambique, Lesotho, Botswana, and Swaziland.
Questions 14 and 15 are based on the following news. At the end of the news item, you will be given 30 seconds to answer the questions. Now listen to the news.
The European Union has drafted a list of U.S. products to be hit with import taxes in retaliation for tariffs the United States has imposed on European steel. EU member governments will review the list before the EU submits it to the World Trade Organization, which arbitrates international trade disputes. EU officials will not say which American products will be hit by the EU sanctions, but diplomats monitoring the most recent transatlantic trade dispute say they include textiles and steel products. Earlier this month, the Bush administration imposed tariffs of up to 30% on some steel imports, including European products. The EU has appealed to the World Trade Organization to get those duties overturned, but a WTO decision on the matter would take up to a year or more. EU officials say that, under WTO rules,
The EU has the right to impose retaliatory measures in June, but they say the United States can avoid the EU's possible countermeasures if it pays more than $2 billion in compensation to the EU for imposing the steel tariffs in the first place. The officials say Washington could also escape retaliation by lowering U.S. import duties on other EU products. The Bush administration says it will not pay compensation.
Section D. Note-taking and gap-filling. In this section, you will hear a mini-lecture. You will hear the lecture once only. While listening to the lecture, take notes on the important points. Your notes will not be marked, but you will need them to complete a 15-minute gap-filling task on answer sheet 1 after the mini-lecture. Use the blank sheet for note-taking. Listen to the mini-lecture. Good morning. Today's lecture will focus on how to make people feel at ease in conversations. I guess all of you sitting here can recall certain people who just seem to make you feel comfortable when they're around. You spend an hour with them and feel as if you've known them half your life. These people who have that certain something that makes us feel comfortable have something in common. And once we know what that is, we can go about getting some of that something for ourselves. How is it done? Here are some of the skills that good talkers have. If you follow the skills, they will help you put people at their ease, make them feel secure and comfortable, and turn acquaintances into friends. First of all, good talkers ask questions. Almost anyone, no matter how shy, will answer a question. In fact, according to my observation, very shy persons are often more willing to answer questions than extroverts. They are more concerned that someone will think them impolite if they don't respond to the questions. So most skillful conversationalists recommend starting with a question that is personal but not harmful. For example, once a famous American TV presenter got a long and fascinating interview from a notoriously private billionaire by asking him about his first job. Another example, one prominent woman executive confesses that at business lunches, I always ask people what they did that morning. It's a dull question, but it gets things going. From there, you can move on to other matters, sometimes to really personal questions. Moreover, how your respondent answers lets you know how far you can go. A few simple catchwords like, really? Yes? Are clear invitations to continue talking. Second, once good talkers have asked questions, they listen for answers. This point seems obvious, but it isn't in fact. Making people feel comfortable isn't simply a matter of making idle conversation. Your questions have a point. You're really asking, what sort of person are you? And to find out, you have to really listen. There are at least three components of real listening. For one thing, real listening means not changing the subject. If someone sticks to one topic, you can assume that he or she is really interested in it. Another component of real listening is listening not just to words, but to tones of voice. I once mentioned D.H. Lawrence to a friend. To my astonishment, she launched into an academic discussion of the imagery in Lawrence's works. Midway through, I listened to her voice. It was, to put it mildly, unanimated, and it seemed obvious that the imagery monologue was intended solely for my benefit, and I quickly changed the subject. And last, real listening means using your eyes as well as your ears. When your gaze wanders, it makes people think they're boring you or what they are saying is not interesting. Of course, you don't have to stare or glare at them. Simply looking attentive will make most people think that you think they're fascinating. Next, good talkers are not afraid to laugh. If you think of all the people you know who make you feel comfortable, you may notice that all of them laugh a lot. Laughter is not only warming and friendly, it's also a good way to ease other people's discomfort. I have a friend whom I enjoy watching at gatherings of people who do not know each other well. The first few minutes of talk are a bit uneasy and hesitant, for the people involved do not yet have a sense of each other. Invariably, a light comment or joke is made, and my friend's easy laughter appears like sunshine in the conversation. There is always then a visible softening that takes place. Other people smile and loosen in response to her laughter, and the conversation goes on with more warmth and ease. Finally, good talkers are ones who cement a parting. That is, they know how to make use of parting as a way to leave a deep impression on others. Last impressions are just as important as first impressions in determining how a new acquaintance will remember you. People who make others really feel comfortable take advantage of that parting moment to close the deal. Men have had it easier. They have done it with a smile and a good firm handshake. What about women then? Over the last several years, women have started to take over that custom as well, between themselves or with men. If you're saying goodbye, you may want to give him or her a second extra hand squeeze. It's a way to say, I've really enjoyed meeting you. But it's not all done with body language. If you've enjoyed being with someone, if you want to see that person again, don't keep it a secret. Let people know how you feel, and they may walk away feeling as if they've known you half their life. Okay, just to sum up, today we've talked about 4 ways to make people feel at ease in conversations. These skills are important in keeping conversations going and in forming friendships later on. Of course, these skills are by no means the only ones we can use. The list is much longer. I hope you will use these 4 skills and discover more on your own in your conversations with other people. Now you have 2 minutes to check your notes. And then please complete the 15-minute gap-filling task on answer sheet 1.